CliffCentral.com.
Well, it is always a great pleasure to have someone of this caliber, and there are very few people in the entertainment business of this caliber. His name, of course, if you've recognized him by now, is Peter Dirk Ace. He is a living legend. And that's not saying too much, because you have been a part of my life since I can recall laughing at the TV. And I think you also helped me as a kid to understand that comedy is really quite clever. I always thought, you know, fart jokes and things like that were enough. But you came on in a time where there wasn't a lot that was funny in apartheid. And as a young kid, I remember watching you and your various characters. And I thought, wow, this is really, really smart. This is clever. This stuff requires someone with brains and an ability to summarize and caricature a person in a way that, honestly, I don't think anyone else in this country's ever got right.
Oh, my goodness, says he, completely dry-mouthed. Thank you. I hope, yes, I am glad to hear that. Not that I ever thought to do that. You know, it's instinct has got a huge amount to do with where we stumble through the minefield thinking that you can buy an ice cream there. And really, when I look back now, and I do look back, because during COVID was a very weird and terrible,
wasn't it?
Extraordinary thing. And everybody I speak to now, not that they say it in so many words, but they all say, my life has been changed by COVID.
Yeah.
Not just because of a virus that you were terrified of, but the fact that you were alone with yourself for 2 years.
And for some people, that's the most scary place you can be.
Very hard. I was even looking at the mirror and thinking, where did you come from? Because, but then what I did was, what do you do? In a weekend in March 2020, you canceled 204 performances in that year over an hour. And I said, and then my theater closed down.
Yeah.
My little venue was over.
In Darling.
But it was like now, boom, boof, in 3 days, boof. I had to get a permit from the police in Darling to go and feed my cats. No, you've got to be there. I said, listen, so give them a chocolate. Anyway, what do I do? Grow a beard. For God's sake, you can't have a beard with Evita. You can have a beard with Margaret Thatcher, but not Evita. And then I said, being a stage manager, I was trained as a stage manager. I thought, let me just sort out things I haven't had the time to do for 40 years. Props, costumes, wigs, clean their eyelashes.
Oh,
so
wow.
So I sat up in my little solid and sorted all that out. And then I thought, well, reading, yes, that was the greatest thing of the two-year period. You could just read a book every 2 days. You've got to just sit there and read with a cat on your lap. But you know, I've got all my plays are on my website, so I've got that there. But I never did my reviews, because a review from 1981 now doesn't make sense.
No.
So I thought, I've got time. But I've got to type them out, because there was no internet. So as I'm typing Adapt or Die, Total Onslaught, Beyond the Rubicon, I'm thinking, how the hell did I get away with this?
Yeah.
Was I mad?
You know, actually, you are very lucky you didn't get into more trouble, because we talk now about the apartheid government and we laugh at them. But I mean, I remember my whole concept of Bia Via Buerta was based on what your caricature of him. Mm. I knew nothing about the man. I was a kid. But I'd see him come on and wave his finger, and you know, and I remember you doing that, and I thought, yeah, he's just summarized this old man who interrupts the cartoons every now and then to make a speech, because he used to.
Mm.
And these were dangerous people, hey?
Very
Magnus Malan, Flock.
Yeah.
These were not people to be trifled with, and you really skirted very close to that edge sometimes. I'm sure there were nights where someone could have made a decision and you might not have been free man.
When I think back now, I think, oh my goodness. I remember the times that things went a little bit awry. I've said awry 2 years ago.
People say
I didn't know there was awry. Yeah. And the security police were outside my house in Melville. This car, it was a Toyota. I thought, what an ugly little color this was.
Yeah, the
and
yellow ones, there. Right?
No, it was a sort of a fail blow. And after about 2 weeks of this, I thought, wait a minute, these are spying on me, these old worms. So I took a tray with Cook Sisters and coffee, and I walked out, not as Evita, I should have, but I didn't.
Oh, that would have been funny.
Walked out, and I sort of hear, worm, I could feel like here. They put the thing up, gone, never saw them
again. Oh, really?
What saved my life? I think silliness. I was silly. I did silly things. I irritated them by wearing a dress or demorphing with a rock.
No, they don't like that. Hey?
And if Evita was the first person to write to them, which she did, and say, you must lock up Peter Dirkhuis. He's a communist and a terrorist. He's wearing women clothing and all that. So anarchy was my key. That was my password and my PIN number. Sexual anarchy, social anarchy, political anarchy, religious anarchy. They didn't know where to fit it in. That was the thing. Now, when I was sitting 2 years ago with this, and I suddenly thought, first of all, how do I go over that? Then, why is the fear still here? Why am I in a democracy of 29 years and I am actually more frightened than I was under apartheid?
Do you think it's because you were young?
No, it's because there was a real light at the end of the tunnel. Uh-huh. Now the light belongs to Eskom.
And we know what happens.
Very, very concerned about the alternative. What is the alternative to a rotten one-man state, one-party state? We went from a one-party state of Afrikaners to a one-party state of, I don't even know what to say here, of clever people.
Well, for clever a while, people, for listen, a while, clever.
No, no, clever, because they know where the money is. They're so, you know, again, what happened with lockdown? For 2 years, we were locked up. We were paralyzed by fear. Clever people knew, and clever people said, hang on, we can take Ukraine. And they did.
Yeah.
We did nothing. And yeah. One thing, we are being blacked out all the time.
Yeah.
And what do? Nothing. I look at France. I look at Paris yesterday. The French are out in the street because they don't want two more years of working. Ha, shame. Where are we with all this thing happening? Pit toilets.
No one's protesting.
We sit here like poopchats. I mean, come on. Anyway, to cut a long story short, because I want to talk to you about recipes, I suddenly thought I need a backstory to my one-man shows just to explain who the characters were in those days. And then I thought, no, but wait, I need another backstory to just put apartheid in perspective. The laws of apartheid, the pencil sketch, the pencil through the hair.
Yeah, that's right.
It was obscene and absurd. You know what? I ended up with 488 pages. So I thought, I've got a book. So I sent it to my publisher. This is in the middle of the lockdown when everybody was not dying, but nearly. And they said, oh, that's wonderful. Yes, yes, yes. We cried. We laughed. We are shocked. But there will be no buyers. And they're right. Who would spend 500 Rand to buy a book about something that happened 40 years ago? So I thought, oh, bugger it. I'll put it into my website. Where it is, it's called One Man Shows, The Black and White Years. And it's been in the website free to anybody. I've had feedback from all over the world. I cannot tell you how extraordinary, including the schools that I sent it to, that whom I've been to with my AIDS program in Mbeki years.
Yeah.
And the kids are doing the sketches. The girls are doing the Winnie Mandela sketch. And then they say, why was Winnie Mandela in a show in 1985? And history walks in through the school door. Is that wonderful?
I love that.
And now my second volume will be out on Madiba Day. That's going to be the Mandela years. Next year, it's going to be the Mbeki years. Then comes the Zuma years. Then comes the man with the sofa and the money years. And then who knows?
Why you think there was confusion about the sofa and the money?
Well, now that was, you know, when that happened, I'm always looking for a hook to hang something on. And I like Cyril. I like him very much. I enjoy the memory of Evita's conversation with him for Funny Galore.
Yes.
Remember the Funny Galore?
And Rolf Meyer.
Yeah. It's all on the YouTube, by the way. All of those
are
available.
Also, we've got to say at this point that actually you can also still buy the DVDs of all your shows as well.
If you find the DVDs.
And there's stuff on the internet too, right?
Yes, yes.
I mean, so... isn't it interesting to see, and we'll come back to the sofa in a moment.
Yes.
I almost gave away the punchline.
Yes.
But isn't it interesting for you to watch how the platforms have changed and the media world has changed and the digital transformation and all that stuff that's happened has changed, but the content remains as fantastic as ever and people just, they want it. And they'll find new ways of getting
it. What is so extraordinary about the kids, the 12-year-old, 8-year-old, 9-year-old kids, they take my material into TikTok.
That's great.
I have Evita on TikTok.
I know.
And she's young and she's sexy.
Yes.
And she's, I kept on thinking, who is this person impersonating my character?
And it was you.
And it's me. It's amazing. And all her 250 Evita free speeches that we did over 4 years, every Sunday we did a free speech of the news and it went into the Daily Maverick.
Right.
And that's on the YouTube as well. And suddenly there it is. No, it's extraordinary. You know, the information. What did we have during the apartheid years? Everything was banned. Everything was censored.
Despite that, you got onto the SABC.
No,
I mean,
I didn't. Evita did.
Evita did.
I
because you could. Put
they
a
never
lot,
got me on.
You could put a lot into Evita that you'd never have gotten away with.
I had
yourself.
Live live, not recorded, not pre-recorded live, but live, Evita live. I was pre-recorded 3 weeks before it came out air because ons moet 'n bietjie kyk wat hierdie mannetjie doen, you know.
No, you were dangerous.
Oh, please.
You were, they thought you were. And I think you were, because if you hadn't done what you did then as a performer and as a character in Evita, it wouldn't have made them look so stupid. Because when people don't know, look at North Korea. They don't allow parody and satire. They don't allow characters like Evita on because it's deadly serious. The moment you open up, you said history walks through the door through some of these things that you did in the 1980s. But if you let a little bit of mockery and laughter and less seriousness and parody and satire, things that people think are complicated but actually are not, when you see it and it opens that curtain just a little bit, the light comes in and it just ruins their party. For people who have no sense of humor, and the only people who I think are truly dangerous in the world, the ones who don't have a sense of humor, you broke those people. Because suddenly, to people like me as a kid, Pierre wasn't a serious person. He was a joke.
Well, that was important to make them feel attacked. Nelson Mandela. How do you make fun of Nelson Mandela? It's like doing Mother Teresa with a dildo. No. You can't do it. You know what I mean?
You can't do it.
But Nelson Mandela had this great sense of humor. He laughed first.
He loved Evita, eh?
He was, oh, Peter, where is Evita? Mm-hmm. And I remember once as Evita on stage at one of these great, great, wonderful, remember in the 90s, he had all the superstars of the world.
We could snap his fingers and bring anyone here.
Yes, but we were proud of us.
Yes.
That's been a long way away. And he always got, get Evita, Evita. And Zelda would phone and another dress, don't wear the same dress because everybody remembers what she wears. And I'd have my 15 minutes of fame behind Evita's eyelashes. And it was always marvelous. And of course, and there were all this Bono and Beyoncé and Queen of Holland. I remember once through the eyelashes seeing, Bill Clinton looking at Evita with a funny look at the yachts.
You know? He was. He's the horniest man in the world.
Nelson Mandela would come onto the stage and he'd hold Evita's hand. And I remember once I said to him, it's a whisper, everybody was dancing. And I said, President Mandela, every time you see me on stage, I'm dressed as Evita Poseidon. He said, don't worry, Petra, I know you're inside.
Oh, wow.
I treasure the man. I treasure Bidiz Matutu. They didn't have a sell-by date.
No, they were the only real celebrities we ever
had. And they are still, to this day, their voices must be heard and repeated. It's so important. That's why the social media can do it, repeat the best.
I do want you to just tell us about Cyril and Sofa before we move on. But then I want to bring up something else that I think you have a unique point of view on that I've been desperate to ask you about. And I waited for this, but the Sofa.
Well, first of all, Cyril, I like Cyril very much. And I was pleased when he became president. And I'm still waiting for you to be president, but I'm sure he will be president. So Cyril, we're going to catch fish together. Okay. Suddenly this thing, drama, 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 bala, bala. What is this? What is he doing? What's happening? What's happening? Millions of dollars in a sofa. I think, wait, hang on. I didn't write the script. What's happening here? And I just thought, this is too good to be true. All I need to do is have a big pink sofa on the stage and I have got my set. So there, Rusbank. It was in the Rusbank. And so I said, okay, now how do I work this into a show? No, but you know, this is the terrible problem. There are too many languages here. We've got 11 official languages. People don't understand each other. Yes, they found all this money lying around. What are we going to do? And then comes a bit of Venda and a little bit of Xhosa, a bit of Zulu. And then somebody says, niemand praat nou so Afrikaans. I'm proud. Okay, so sit die geld in the Rusbank.
Meaning,
put the money in the Russian bank. Excuse me, because they've all got secret bank accounts in St. Petersburg, but now they put it in the sofa. It's too good to be true.
I love it. It writes itself, but we need your genius to make it happen because I've never heard anything that true and that sad at the same time. So Barry Humphries died.
Oh, yes.
Now, Barry Humphries died just this weekend. Mm. And what I loved about Barry Humphries, besides Dame Edna and all those terrific shows that he used to do, was here was a guy who totally inhabited his character, much like you did, Evita. And I'm sure that your careers worked in parallel. In those days, you couldn't hop on the internet and see what the other guy was doing. But to me, you are similar in my mind. You're both tremendously clever, great writers, great satirists, just unbelievably confident on stage. Apart from the fact that you'd put on this other persona who was powerful beyond belief in your case and his. And you could address anyone as your equal in that persona, which you did and which he did. I think about the way that that broke so many blockages and obstructions between, you know, old kind of conservative stereotypes of men dressing up as women.
Yeah.
Second of all, the fact that these two were these larger than life characters who just had an ability to poke fun at everything and everyone. I mean, Barry Humphreys would go and sit in the royal box and then be told
Better seat.
I got a better seat and get up and go with these enormous glasses and this over the top dresses. And you did the same thing with Evita, also on the international stage, where you were able to just for a moment let people imagine a world where someone this fun could exist.
Well, you know, Jeff, you talk about the world. Evita on a stage in Berlin, she got the Teddy Award.
Yes.
And there was this huge audience in Berlin, and there was Evita Bezet. Frau Evita Bezet, sie ist hier aus Südafrika, und das ist wunderbar. And Evita goes, she says, ja, bye donkey, thank you very much. She says, I am an Afrikaner. Ich ist Afrikaner. Ich bin ein Afrikaner.
Oh.
And then later in the speech, she said, you know,
JFK
you
would
Germans,
love that.
You Germans have done so much for us in South Africa, especially us Afrikaners. You've set us such a high example. It would take us a long time before we have killed 6 million blacks.
Ooh.
You could have torn that audience into for a second of, and I thought,
I've gone
and
too far.
Then they exploded with applause. There was a sound you couldn't
And the
believe.
Germans notoriously have this unfair characterization of not having a sense of humor, but for them to laugh at that, you must have first felt incredible relief.
What it was, I call a Murseklap in die Gesicht. But that's what Evita. You see, again, getting back to Barry, getting back to Edna, Barry Humphreys was probably my most challenging inspiration. Going back to in the 70s, when I was in London at the London Film School, I was there for 2 years as a student. And then I graduated and I thought, Christmas cook, I'm not going back to South Africa, because I'd seen the BBC documentaries of what my generation of Afrikaans boys had to do under orders of bang, 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 and the children died.
Yeah, there's this brilliant movie they did recently, Morphe.
Yes, absolutely.
Which was really just an interesting way of kind of looking at how young South African men would have had to have been
forced in there.
And especially guys who, you know, were gay or grew up with slightly different identities or whatever it might have been.
On top of everything, it was that as well. I mean, on top of everything, it was that as well. And then I created a job for myself at the film school to create the library because they didn't have one. And for the next year, my job was to go and find, I said to the principal, you need real actors to talk to the students who are directing their girlfriends in films. That doesn't work. Oh, he said, do some. And so I get Glenda Jackson on the phone. She just won an Oscar on the phone book.
Wow.
And she came and all that. And all those things. Okay, so all the experience of being in London with that extraordinary freedom, except the reality that all the homosexuality was not a crime, it was still very dangerous. But I thought, this is like walking the beachfront in Sea Point, so I know how to hide. Barry Humphreys. First, Danny LaRue, this extraordinary drag Danny LaRue, wonderful costumes and funny and packed out houses and just every now and then he'll just use his men's voice of hello, mate. But I saw the early Barry Humphreys when he did sketches of an old man who's lost his mind. And I mean, really some incredibly important things. Then, of course, Edna, who was quite ugly. Edna was sort of a real housewife.
Yeah.
And then she became Dame Edna. And things
became
glamorous. Glamorous and glamorous. And I thought, this is before Evita was even in my mind. I just thought, I love that. I want to do that. At the film school, I did a girl in a commercial because the actress didn't turn up. So I said, oh, give me the dress. I'll do it myself. Dame Edna is a superstar, housewife superstar, but very apolitical.
Yes.
Evita
absolutely.
Is totally political. Yeah. But the biggest difference between the two is that Evita Bezuidenhout does not have a sense of humor. Evita Bezuidenhout does not understand irony. Edna has a magnificent sense of humor soaked with irony.
So in some ways you made Evita harder.
Well, not harder.
Because you have a sense of humor. To play someone who has no sense of humor.
No. I must tell you something. It's a huge relief. It's you. First of all, the relief is that she is not a copy of Dame Edna.
No, no, not at all.
She is not. She does not have the big glasses and and the purple hair and all that.
But
and she's the first person who would say, "Only sis."
But even though you were dressing up, it was believable.
Yes.
I mean, you took the trouble to make sure that everything about her was as authentic as possible.
Well, if she wasn't believable, Puk Buerta wouldn't have fallen in love with her. And you know, we spread that rumor in 1981-82 that Puk Buerta was having an affair with Evita Bisignat, and he started believing it. And I have got faxes which he sent her at 2 o'clock in the morning. Obviously, and also giving tips of how to make jokes and things about extraordinary. So I had, and I also had Dr. Pete Kurnov, who just loved what I did, which was bad for business. You don't want the other side to be a fan. And he said, thank you. No, Peter, you know very much, but I like satire. Your satire is very important. Look at me, he said.
You told me, I'm sorry to keep going on these tangents, but you told me something fascinating when I saw you the last time about Pete Kurnov. And what was his girlfriend, Marcel?
Yes, Marcel.
And you told me about
the lady of color.
And you told me about his ex-wife.
This is a very extraordinary story. I heard, again, I wasn't there at the time.
Mm. I mean, it makes all the players come out well.
It's a very important story. Pete, of course, had left his Afrikaans wife and he moved in with a lady of color. And that was like, he's proved
Marcel
to the world
Adams,
that apartheid, yes, Marcel, he's proved to the world that apartheid will never work. And that was lots of fun. And he took the jokes. He even brought his two little twins to the perron and with Marcel. And Evita said from the stage, Pete, are you really the father of two little boys? And Pete Kurnov said, Janir.
Wow.
Then Marcel left him with the children. She took the children. She went to Germany with a man. She fell in love with somebody else. Pete on his own. Then somebody said to me, you know, Pete Kurnov was at the spa and he ordered things and he went and he said he doesn't have to pay because he's a cabinet minister. He's losing it.
Shame.
I said, no, wait. What do you mean he's losing it? And then I went to on my way to town one day. I went into the spa there in Milnerton and I knew the spa man because he used to be in Darning. I said, what's happening? We're having a terrible time because, yes, he comes beautifully dressed. He's obviously on his way to Parliament. It's very wrong. I said, well, the first thing you do is open an account for him. I pay for it. Whatever he buys, you put on the account. If it's chocolates, it's wine, it's that. Please do that. And this went on for a few weeks and I kept on checking and I just thought, do I go and interfere? And I thought, no, don't frighten him and me. And then somebody said, you know what happened last week? His wife and his son came in the car and Pete was walking back from somewhere in the street, beautifully dressed, and they stopped the car and they said, hello, Papa. And he said, hello. And they said, get into the car. And he got into the car and they took him home and they looked after him till he died. His wife looked after him till he died.
The wife he'd abandoned.
Yes, that is so profound. And I'm happy to spread that story. You know, I think there were lots of details in the story of pain and of confusion and all the things. But somehow, you know, that's really a smart story.
Well, I'm glad you got to tell it here because when you told me, it gave me goosebumps.
Yeah.
You know, it's also a rare thing for someone who used to have fun with these people, used to make fun of them, but in a you know, gentle, generous sort of way. I don't think you've ever been mean.
I don't want to be mean.
But
the temptation is huge, but I don't want to be mean.
Not sure. But the fact that you could then be in a position where you could tell a story like this that's actually quite heartfelt. And
well, it's a
serious,
human story. You know? It's, you know, one seldom thinks of them in politics as human. I mean, one thing Pete Quinn said to me at a lunch,
because he was a bastard in his time.
Listen, politicians have no excuse. They've got no excuse what happens. They could say no, but they don't.
Right.
But he said to me, we had lunch together because I wanted to take my father. My father said, "Ik kom nie na by die donors." My father just hated them so much because they gave him a hard time because he married a Jew, to the point that he and she never told me that my mother was a Jew.
Well, that's something we've got to unpack in a second.
Okay.
Yeah.
He said to me at the lunch, he said, you know, Peter, you make fun of me. In Afrikaans, maybe, but I'm sending it. You make fun of me, and I don't mind because I've got funny ears, and my mother always said, you know, ooh, you're a clown. He said, but you must always remember that I've always been the choice of two evils. I thought, what? What is this? He said, yes, right on the tablecloth. It doesn't matter. Let's make a list of all the people in the cabinet who would be better than me at my job. And we could not find one.
Hmm.
He said, so I am doing the job because I'm the best of two evils. Very strange, very
strange.
What
a way to characterize yourself.
And quite chilling.
Yeah.
And quite chilling. I mean, did he lose sleep because of what he was doing? Was he? I don't know. I don't want to make any apology or anything. But again, you see, all these things, and they come from all sides, especially now, when you've got this extraordinary chorus line of creatures that you can't even think about in a horror movie. And there's a lot of stuff that you actually can't make fun of because there's no fun to be had here.
Well, they're so villainous, right? And I mean, you need a little bit of human in the package.
Well, you know, there's a difference for me, very big difference between comedy and humor. Comedy is the joke, and jokes are great. Great.
Yeah.
Can't tell them because I forget them and I come with the punchline. But humor is like a fingerprint. Everybody's got a sense of humor, which is different. Everybody. Mainly, sadly, a sense of humor in a child is killed by parents and teachers. Wat doen jy? Wie dink jy is jy? Blestel. You know, tuk-tuk.
But well, those horrible humor, words, that's not funny.
That's not funny. Who do you think? Okay. The thing with a sense of humor is you walk into a room, as an example, walk into a room and your best friend is behind the door. You walk into the room and they come out and say, boo! You go, ha! And then you go, ha ha, it's you. It's not because it's funny, it's because somebody's there that you know. Yeah. And I think I want to use humor to make people laugh at their fear, like I laugh at my fear. When you laugh at your fear, you make that fear less fearful. It's still lethal. It can still kill you, but you're looking at it. If you look away, it becomes 20 foot high, not 20 inches high.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I try and keep in my framework. My definition, what I work by, is 41%, 49% anger, 51% entertainment, not the other way around.
Okay. That's channeling your anger in a way more constructive form than most
but
of us.
But anger, raw anger is... If people walk away, who needs it? You get it all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you traffic get the shot all the time. So you don't want that. Yeah.
Rise where people complain the whole time.
All the
time.
Nah, man.
So you mentioned now your father and your mother. And actually in your latest show, The Echo of a Noise, you talk about them in some detail. I mean, I also think it's really interesting that you've brought them to the fore. Hannes, that's your dad, and Helga, your mother. And you know, it's always been you and your characters, and this time we're kind of getting a bit of the backstory as well.
Mm.
But the story of your mother and your Jewishness is also the subject of some of the more serious work that you've done.
Mm.
And your character there, who we've got to know very well, the sort of mock Jewish kind of, you know, you're sort of integrating your Jewishness into your life. And I don't want to try and... I don't want to disassemble and try to figure out how the process works in your head, but you've made this a part of the arsenal of characters too.
Mm.
And this has been a hard process for you because you've had to rediscover things that you never knew that were kept from you that I think must be quite painful to discover, especially later in life.
Well, you know, people talk about denial.
Yeah.
You know, denial. And you think of denial, Thabo Mbeki's denial about HIV and AIDS and all that. But I grew up in a house, happy house. Well, yes, of course, not so happy, but a happy house. As a little boy, and I was very on my own because I had an imagination. I had a friend called George. Mm. George and I played Dinky Toys together. We had all sorts of things. And my sister Tessie came and kicked George and my Dinky Toys into the grass. And my mom, a concert pianist, my father, a musician. And so Mozart was my best friend. And I had wonderful friends who were Jewish. The little boys that were, their mothers were also musicians and they would come with their violins and there would be chamber music. And I always loved going to visit my Jewish friends because the food was divine.
Mm.
And their mothers were divine. Hello, Peter. How's it? You know, I always fell in love with my Kugel mother, the Kugel mothers. And that's why Noelle Fine is one of my treasured characters because I love her. And I do her with enormous amount of love and affection. But nobody said anything to me about my mother being Jewish. My mother used to come with us to church in Chikerk and get the giggles. We got the giggles always in church with my mother. It was terrible. Because with the hat, she always had to wear a hat in church. Why did nobody talk to me about that? I have no answer. I can imagine answers, but I haven't got the answer. Okay. The first thing is my mother came from Berlin, 1936. Her fiancé, who was not Jewish, said to her, I can't protect you anymore. Go to Cape Town to your parents. He had already sent her parents to Cape Town 3 years before. And I'll tell you when to come back because this noise or this Hitler thing will be over.
Sure. Okay.
So she arrives in Cape Town with a piano. The first professional job she got was to play a two-piano Mozart concerto with a South African pianist called Hannes Eis. So my pa and my mom meet.
Wow.
And marry in the during the war, and then I am born just after the war. I'm born in September 1945. I'm circumcised, okay. My pa always said it's a healthy thing to do. Not okay. that we talked about penises, but I mean, I was very jealous of his when I saw it once in a shower. I thought, well, I wasn't one like that. But nobody talked about it. And I have heard somebody said to me, someone who knew my parents, who has now died, this wonderful friend of the family, said, you don't, do you know why you don't know? I said, no, why? Wasn't I listening? She said, no, actually, your father was told not to talk about it. Your father was told by his cousin, Dr. D.F. Malan, the Prime Minister of South Africa, Hannes, jy praat nie oor jou vrou Helga nie. Ons wil nie hê jy is nie met die Jood getrou nie. Because Afrikaners don't like anybody.
Yeah,
okay?
That's just absolutely unbelievable.
I mean, shocking beyond words. So she had to deny because she was an extraordinary, when I think back and with such love, and I wished I had the courage to have spoken to her and asked her things. I never did. And she, the first thing she did, she learned Afrikaans. Being a musician, she knew the language, the tune. The song,
sure.
The music. And she spoke a wonderful Afrikaans with wonderful German words tucked in every now and then. But she did it very much on purpose. Tannie Helga. Tannie Helga is Afrikaanse vrou. Tannie Helga kan ook Duits praat. So there's a huge amount of baggage, which I haven't knitted this into what I mean,
Peter, when you think about it, this woman, she might not have made it here. You might not have ever been born. We know what happened to so many Jews who were in Germany.
Yes.
And by the skin of her teeth, she was here, and then she met your father. And then to live this life where almost it was a character for her whole life long.
And to survive because of the power of the name. But then she drove up to Chapman's Peak and jumped off the mountain. Now, there is another, excuse me, what did you say there? She committed suicide. I mean, you never recover from that. And you never understand it.
How old were you?
I was, well, listen, it was 1969. I was 19. No, I was a bit older, actually. And my sister, she was just turning 20. That, it was terrible for her, Tessie. And my ma was so close with the music and everything. But, you know, again, I don't have any blame. I don't have any negative feel. Listen, she loved us. She was given... She was given pills for her depression, which is also something I have to work through. Why? For so many years did she have depression and we never knew. She hid it from us as well. And the doctor's assistant, he wasn't there, was playing golf, and the assistant didn't tell her that the pills would take her down before the pills took her up. And she took two pills before she went to the recital, to play a recital at the SABC studios to record Mozart, Bach, Beethoven, Schubert. And she went to the piano to do something at the keyboard, and her fingers wouldn't work. Well, no, the pills were working. Her biggest nightmare was going mad because her mother was a bit milly. She was wonderful. She was so eccentric. She was, you know, she was just, and she went blind. And so being a blind lady, she made fun of it. And that was even more difficult for people to understand. That's why I loved it tremendously. Anyway, and my mother, she committed suicide. That she drove and she left a note for us, and that was the end of that life, end of our life. And so I've had to work through that, and my sister has to work through it, and my father had to work through it. How can he understand that? Nobody could understand it. So she has left me with the knowledge of the fact that she divided her energy into three people. My father became a nicer person. My sister became an extraordinary pianist, and I started writing because she always said to me, I think you could write. And I got there. No, Ma, I'm going to be an actor. Yes, 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 yes. But you will be a writer. So celebration time.
Yeah. There's so many questions with something like this. There's that you must go over and over stuff in your head. Think about things that you think she said, that you might have heard, what you might have been able to say to her if she was around now. These are things that I think a lot of people deal with. And the depression, you say you're dealing with it as well.
I am
you think
not,
it's...
no, I have no, no, I don't have any problem with that at all. Not at all. I've needed to really study it to understand it and not to say, oh, darling, you know.
So how do you understand it? Is it chemical? Is it genetic?
I think it's all of those things. I mean, it's really, I'm not qualified to actually have an opinion here, except to say, be generous with your attention. Be careful of not being, of not frightening somebody with it. Or just saying, oh, never mind. You know, like people say, oh, darling, you know, have a discipline. You know, get over it. You know, get over it. But you know, the most important thing that I am with me all the time is, and I say this very much at the end of my one man thingy at the theater at the moment, is my father has just died. He's just died. I held his hand and looked at him, knowing that this is the one time in my life I'm not going to look away. I was always looking away from everything. Oh, no, I don't want to look. I'm not going to look. So, and he squeezed my hand. Suddenly, this man who was dying squeezed my hand. Yes, it was good to break my fingers. And then suddenly, pop, gone. Suddenly, it was gone. Like, he's gone. And I was there with Sunny, our maid, quote unquote. She was my Cape Flats mother.
Mm.
She closed his eyes.
Sure.
And I went back to the house. It was just before Christmas, and I'm standing in the music room with the Christmas tree and the music and all the things, the memory things and everything we had as a family. And the first thing I thought was, why did I not ask Pa more about his life? Why didn't I ask him more about Ma's life? Why was it always about my life? How is it possible that I know more about Sophie Loren's family than my own family? I cannot tell you how many people in the last, how long have I been doing this? I've been doing this piece for nearly 8 years. The echo of a noise, waited for me afterwards and said, I'm going to phone my grandmother now because I have also not asked my parents because we were brought up not to ask questions. For God's sake, no, for your sake, ask questions. Find out. And many people have said, I phoned my granny and I said, when did you have your first climax? And she told me. You know, it's this thing we brought up, especially Afrikaners. You know, you praat nie, you vraag nie, and you never thought of that. I wanted to ask my mother, what was it like in 1936? The Gestapo were marching down the street. My mother, they were on the third floor of this beautiful apartment building, which is still there, I must tell you. Mm-hmm. It had a sort of a round tower thing, and she had a piano in that, and she used to play the piano. And then the Nazis came and put a red swastika thing right down, and the swastika was there, and she said it cut the sun away from my music. And so she took a scissor and she cut a square out of the flag, and she played her music. And there was a bakery at the bottom, a butcher was at the bottom. It was his shop at the bottom, and they were friends, and he also loved music. And and he would with a knife on the pipe knock, because the police were coming, the Gestapo were coming. And the Gestapo were there, and then she would put away the picture of her father with his iron cross, because he got an iron cross in the First World War. And she quickly put with pins the swastika back, and she was there, and they came in, and they sniffed around, and they went in, and then they left without her, thank God. So, you know, I want to ask her, what was it feeling sitting around the table where Franz Michels, her fiancé, and you were all, and the grandpa, her parents were sitting around. Who decided on Cape Town?
Yeah.
Why not Canada? Why not everywhere else? Why Cape Town? You know, now I say, well, what can be further away from Nazi Germany than South Africa? Oh, my God, that's a combination. You know? So, I mean, it is...
Thank goodness they made the decisions they made. Yeah. We're much richer for you having been born here and holding up a mirror to all of us.
Thank you. I'm glad to hear that.
So you mentioned Sophia Loren, and it is like she was the other woman.
She is the other woman. She she says that about
Evita. Right?
She says, you know, the woman you do, she's starting to look like me. Sophia, you taught me the eye makeup. I do Sophia's eye makeup.
But this is a story I don't think many people who've just seen your material and looked at all the amazing things that you've done over your life, they probably don't know the depth of this relationship. So I want you to tell it like you told the Pete Quernoff story, because it's quite something.
Well, You know, when I was a little boy, 11 years old, I loved movies. I loved movies. I fell in love with Debbie Reynolds. I thought she was absolutely fantastic. I thought she was great. I think I wrote a letter to MGM and I got a picture, which was nice. I didn't put it on anywhere, but it was my picture. But Dr. Verwoerd was a picture I had on my wall because he was the god. He was a gift from God. There was no talk about, you know, apart, it was a gift from God. And I had a picture of Dr. Verwoerd because all my friends also had a picture of Dr. Verwoerd. My father was very angry. He said, "Geen politiek in my huis nie."
Really?
Yeah. Hell is fail. It's a fail.
Even with DF being his cousin.
No, he didn't want to talk about it. I only really found out long after.
Do you remember anything of
DF? No, I had no contact with him at all. No.
Really?
So then I found this picture in the Stage and Cinema magazine of the Sophia, beautiful Sophia. She was doing Houseboat with Cary Grant.
Sure.
I cut it out and I stuck it on the wall next to Verwoerd, and Verwoerd fell off the wall. The next day, she saved my life. And so Sophia, my father teased me. "You like Sophia Loren?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Ach, Peter, die dik lippe. Jou Sophia Loren is a mate."
Sure.
My audience makes a noise when I say that word. They go, "Oh, yes, good. Make a noise." And it broke my heart. I said, "But how can she see? She's not a color, she's an Italian." And then every time I looked at that face smiling at me, I thought, "Oh no, I've broken God's commandment. I've fallen in love with the colored." Anyway, things went on. I collected pictures of Sophia and I did school and I became a trick. And my mom gave me a return ticket to the Northern Hemisphere as a present. She said, go and see where I come from. And so I went to London and a friend of hers took me to see Othello, the play.
Well, that was banned.
Othello,
yeah, right?
Othello with Laurence Olivier. I thought it was Laurence Olivier, you know. I went to Germany. I met her fiance with his wife. And then I wanted to go to Rome because Sophia lives in Rome. And I had a picture of Sophia, which I'd cut out of the Oggi magazine, waving at the camera from the apartment window, from her apartment. Behind her was an ornate lamppost, and behind the lamppost was a ruin. So for the next 3 days, I walked around Rome with this picture, trying to find the lamppost and the ruin, and I found them. In the shadow of the Victor Emmanuel Monument, there was the window and there was Sophia's flat. So I wrote a letter and I went up there, left the letter for her. She wasn't there, but the woman said she'd give the letter. Went back, all the way back to South Africa after this. Weeks later, and I get to Pinelands and there's a letter for me from Sophia. On the back she'd written, "From Sophia Loren." So I wrote back to her and she wrote to me. And she wrote to me and I wrote to her. We became pen friends. And the day I was standing outside the crematorium chapel where my mother was being buried, and there was no music. Somebody had forgotten to put on the music, and they put on its cassette, and it had been warped in the sun. It was, it was like a circus. It was too terrible, and I just ran out. And I thought, I don't know what to do. And I wrote a letter to this address of Sophia, and I just said, I don't know what to do. And a letter came back, and she just said, "You've got to help your father and your sister. You can't cry now. You will cry one day, but not now. Now you must be brave. Be brave. I love you, Sophia." That changed my life. Be brave, yes. Just, you know, don't help here. Eventually, I met her. Eventually, I had a drink with her in her apartment in Paris. We were like we'd known each other 1,000 years. We laughed, and I brought stamps for her little children, her boys, little boys, Chippy and Eduardo. And wherever we've been in the same place together, we've seen each other. She was signing books in one of her books in an apartment in New York. And I got her on the phone and she said, come, I want to see you, but come and watch me. Come and watch me work. Come and see what I do. What are we going to do? She's signing books. I said, "You sign books?" "No, Sophia." She gets on the chair, this Wiggly's chair, and there are hundreds of people. And somebody helps her onto the desk where she's standing, and on her high heel shoes, and they hand her the book and hold her ankle so she doesn't fall. Sophia Loren. She stands there and she waves at her people, so that knowing that they can't all be there to have a book sign. Again, I thought, yeah, that's it. That's how you do your job. She came to my show in Hollywood with her son Eduardo, and as I was putting her together. You know, I do the Kugel, my Kugel sketch. He's putting the makeup on, so I've got Evita's eyelashes on eventually. And I just heard him say, "Hey, mama, she looks like you."
Oh, wow.
And then we many moments of and letters and talk. And, you know, during COVID, I spoke to her every week, sometimes twice a week. She was so scared. She was in her apartment in Geneva, and her family was in America. They couldn't see each other. Yeah, I know all that. And we sang songs on the thingy together. We sang Isaac. She would sing. And I did this last year when I was with her in Geneva. We sit there and like two kids with ice creams. And then she suddenly said, "Oh, doctor, I'm in trouble.
Well, goodness gracious me.
For every time a certain man is standing next to me, my pulse becomes a race." And so we sang songs together, me doing the Peter Sellers part and she doing the Sophia Loren part. So the bottom line is very simple. I love her so much because she has helped me so much. And, you know, when we did the documentary, they did the documentary of me about 5 years ago called No One Started Laughing. Sophia was in it because I said to her on the phone, "Are we going to do a documentary about me?" She said, "About you." And she said, "I want to be in it." I said, "What?" She said, "Of course, I'm your best friend. Sophia Loren, you want to be in my film?" She said, "Of course." And so she was. And then when the film was done, we went to, that was another story, filming it with her. It was just so wonderful. And we had the film. And then, is she going to come to the premiere in Cape Town, in Johannesburg? No. She's 80. She's not happy in an aeroplane. I want to take the film to her. And the producer said, "You're on." So we did a cassette. And I flew to Geneva. And I said to her, "I'm coming to show you the film." She said, "We'll have a premiere." I said, "Yes." I go to her, knock on the door. She's wearing a Hollywood costume. Oh, she's like, I said, "Look at you." She said, "Of course. It's a world premiere." And we sit. And I brought a Cook Sisters from South Africa. We have Cook Sisters and we're watching the film. And Charlize Theron was in the movie and was so moving. And Sophia with the tears. And she suddenly took my hand and she said, "Thank you for making me part of your life." Oh. So why am I saying this to the world? I'm saying this to anybody who's listening. Do not ever be ashamed of falling in love with talent and beauty, even if they are 10,000 miles away. It's what they do to you and for you. And when you know them and meet them, yeah, they're exactly what you wished for. That's why Donald Trump is not on my wall.
I mean, if she hadn't said, "Be brave."
She didn't have to. Nobody.
No, but, you
know,
but
yes, I know.
What
I
that
know,
did
at that
for
moment,
you.
But all that. Sure. I mean, it's a lesson I've learned, and I have a huge, huge love for... I mean, what I do now at the Monte Cassino Theatre, after I've done this 90 minutes on stage with the story to my audience, I say to them, "Give me a few minutes and I'll join you in the foyer. We can have a drinky together and we can do a selfie. I want to also give you me to put on your wall." And then they tell me, and then these wonderful old ladies who are younger than me say, "I also went through that. And my husband and my children and then my grandchildren." And so many have said to me in the last few days, "What do I say to my grandchildren who are all wanting to leave?"
Yeah.
"Because now that I've seen what you've said to me, I want them to come and see it because they'll want to stay." And I said, yes. First of all, it's a choice that everybody can make. But don't run. Don't run away. Run towards. If there's a reason to go, run towards. Don't run away. There's no reason to run away. And I am angry. I'm so angry about the fact that so many people have lost hope. I have huge optimism about the future of this country. Because just to tell you, in the last few days, I've had interviews for tiny little newspapers all over Johannesburg, which I love. I love the little freebie newspapers. I think they're terribly important because they spread lots of information.
Mostly they're the only ones that are still around.
Yes. And these young men, and they were not white men, they were black men, young black men with enormous background, have done enormous amount of homework, have got such wonderful ideas, are writing. And I think to myself, that's all I want to know for me to believe in the future of South Africa, you know, and I have young people. Simple, that the politicians have turned themselves into the royal family. They're the royal family, and that's why everything has got to be about them. No, politicians work for us. We do not work for them.
Yeah, but
they must get out
there,
and they must do their job. And quite frankly, everybody is hiding behind our great constitution. Yes.
Yeah.
Now we must just do a little PS. From now on, South African politicians are not innocent until proved guilty. They are guilty until proven innocent. Finish and start. It's time.
You know, this optimism, this relentless ability that you have to keep working and to keep writing and to keep performing and to keep telling these amazing stories. And you really are unparalleled in your ability to do that. Where does it come from? Because a lot of people are struggling. A lot of people have given up hope. And I suppose there might be one or two of them listening now going, but, you know, I don't have that feeling of optimism. Where do I get it?
Phew, I don't know where I get it. I just know when it sort of takes a day off. It sometimes takes a day off.
And then?
Then I am very careful just to feed the cat with love and have a piece of paper and a pencil nearby so that I can just write down the reasons why I am quite not happy.
Is that where that 49% angry comes from?
Oh, sometimes? God, yes. But no, it's much more. I don't want them to win. Again, my father, in all this chaos and things of not getting on with each other, I suggested to him he must be a member of the censor board. So at the worst time of me being banned by the censors, my father was a censor. I mean, how's that for crazy?
Oh,
if you can't
God.
Beat them, go in there and pee in their beds, you know, make a poop on their dinner plates.
Yeah.
Okay. And my father then said to me about a week after that, he said, come and have lunch with me. He chucked me out of the house. This was during the years of the space. It was in the 70s. And I went back and he said to me, are you scared of them? I said, it's a national party government. It's not the censor board. I said, no, but it's the same thing. He said, it's not the same thing. I'm one of them. And they're idiots. They don't know what they're doing. They've just cut up a Fellini film. I don't know what to do. I want to kill them. Don't let them frighten you. Markala balachlak. That came from my pa.
That's strong
laughable.
Stuff.
And I do this now. Make them laughable. But you say, there's a very interesting thing that I am prisoner of at the moment. I am very aware of the thin line between racism and satire.
Sure.
Mm? And because I'm a white person, although I did find out that we had a lady in our background many, many centuries ago who plied her trade on the road between Cape Town and Paarl, and her name was Wilhelmina Opklum. So I'm also a colored. I said, don't talk to me.
I'm
a colored.
Yeah.
You know, I want to make fun of the politicians as I did with my family, the politicians, the Afrikaners, but I can't do that.
Yeah,
white criticism of black action is not operative. It doesn't work. Although it worked totally, the celebration of Nelson Mandela and Desmond Tutu and Winnie, I was a huge, huge fan of Winnie, you know, give and take all the darkness and the question marks, and we liked each other. She still sent me a wonderful picture of her in her drag, her causa drag,
sure,
with a note saying, Mr. Ace, the day you do me on stage, please look like this.
Oh,
I like
wow.
that. The ANC has lost its sense of humor. It's there.
Yeah.
And also, which I want to, you know, so, okay. So I am very careful to try and criticize where I can without stepping into the minefield of you racist, you can't do characters like that because you're making fun of us as black people. I don't want to do that. I can make fun of Julius Malema because he has a gift. You just have to use, sure. you know, and I will.
He does it himself.
But I didn't make fun of Eugène Blanche either because I have very little respect for certain politicians. I don't want to waste my time on them. But it is a very interesting experience to have Evita there because she is a member of the African National Congress. In 2012, I realized that she's useless in opposition. She has her own little party, Evita, you were the EPP, Evita's People's Party, the EPP, you know, the EPP. And I use that party when I do voter education, which is very important every election time. But she now cooks for reconciliation. She's in the Lutuli House kitchen. She knows that the way to a politician's mind is not through his brain, it's through his stomach. And she just looks at Gwede Mantashe to know that it's true. And she gets involved and she has a little Twitter. She has a little, what's it, a little tweet thing at Tani Evita, where she shares things with people. She's got 199,000 people. What do you call
followers?
Followers.
Followers.
God, I sound like Zoom. I'm trying to say the amount, 100 million, trillion. And Evita can, as a member of the ANC, but also as a diplomat, ex-diplomat, also as a Democrat, also as an Afrikaner, also as a woman, also as somebody who's got three grandchildren. They're not black, they're not white, they're Barack Obama beige.
Right.
So she's right in the middle of the pudding. She can say these things.
Okay, she can, and I've recently seen Evita doing her thing, and she still skirts really close to that line sometimes, where there are people in the audience, maybe, and I'm not going to be disparaging about them, but maybe these people have grown up in an era of cancel culture and mm-hmm. political correctness.
I'm aware of that too, yes.
And, you know, all of that stuff mm-hmm. is going on. And they go, oh, when certain things are said. And there may even be people who were old fans of yours who go, oh, well, I don't know. I mean, I used to really like Evita, but I can't stomach what she says there. They're always going to be those people.
I might agree with them.
Sure, but it's such a tough line to walk. You said it yourself just now. Do you believe that the audience has changed? Or that the jokes have changed, or that Evita's changed?
Everything. Audience has changed. Jokes are very thin on the ground because usually it's the truth with a little tale. And Evita has, yes, Evita has changed. I mean, first of all, I lost her during COVID. I mean, suddenly it was over. Then I was doing all my stage management things, sorting the wigs out.
Did it take a while to get back into her?
Well, this is what I'm telling you.
Oh.
I found this gray wig and I suddenly thought, but what's Evita doing now in this lockdown? She can't go to the hairdresser. She's going to be without a hairdresser for how many months? What happens to a woman's brown hair when she doesn't have it dyed properly? She will not be a happy cat.
Mm-mm.
And so I put on this wig and it was a Meryl Streep wig. It was a sort of a short Judi Dench look.
Right.
And I thought, there we are. And when Evita made her first appearance, going with the premier of the Western Cape, Mr. Windy, to have a vaccination, she had a new look and the media went crazy. She was on the front page of even the Citizen. No, not just the Citizen, even the City Press and all the, you know, who aren't keen to putting white people anywhere. But there she was. And so it was really a very nice renaissance. So she's strong. Now she's working very hard to sort out the menu for Vladimir Putin when he comes.
Yes.
She's already arranged for him to actually take meals in her kitchen because she locks the door. Nobody comes into her
and
kitchen.
And no one will arrest him there.
No, she's going to say that he's her husband.
Oh,
and he might joke at you. So we're going to go full steam ahead in this. And then next year, I've got a piece coming on in Johannesburg just before the election, which I am not taking lightly. The election, I'm not taking lightly at all.
Okay.
And it is Evita, who is now in front of the Disciplinary Commission of the African National Congress because she's taking the party into disrepute.
Oh,
that opens 1,000 windows and 12 doors. So I am working at it. And please, members in Lutuli House, keep giving me material.
Yeah,
especially.
They can't help.
Mulula.
Fikile.
I've been praying for you for so long. Just keep doing what you're doing. And the ANC will be something of the past very quickly.
So voter education and AIDS are two things just off the top of my head that you've mentioned now that are massively important to you. Because during the whole HIV situation that Thabo Mbeki created, where, you know, HIV is not related to AIDS and we don't have a policy and we're not going to supply antiretrovirals. And it was the most bizarre thing looking back now.
Beetroots, African potatoes, and garlic.
I mean,
and
still,
all that.
When I think back on it, this is the level of just ham-handed and stupid stuff that we've forgotten that was an era we lived through. But you took it seriously and you were one of the brave voices who continued to fight that good fight. And voter education is another one. And there are a few others that you take very seriously.
Well,
you deploy the characters. You deploy yourself. You do a lot of this stuff not for money.
No. That was a very interesting moment. The HIV thing was, first of all, the 388,000 people. 380. You know, when I read all these letters, Thabo Mbeki writes 12-page letters. Clever man. I said, yes, darling, but you were responsible for the confusion that led to the death of 388,000 people more that died of COVID in South Africa. So I'm going to remind people, Thabo, I'm watching you. I knew, 2001. I mean, I've been living with this terror of HIV AIDS, being gay. Oh my God, have I done the wrong thing?
It was a gay thing.
It was a gay thing.
I mean, you remember being around at the time when Freddie Mercury, it was devastating.
And my friends and people I knew and things I had done. I mean, heaven's sake, you're not gay to just talk about it. You're gay to do it. Hello.
Yeah.
You know, was that to be, oh, crikey. And And then I said, "Doctor, I'm denying my own anger here, and I've got to do something." So I thought, I have got to start putting it into my work, because the democracy was a very nice thing to celebrate, but it wasn't as entertaining as fascism. But suddenly there was HIV and AIDS and Mbeki. And so I thought, now I must do my research, which I did. And I sort of structured a little sort of some sketches and characters, and what will Tani Evita do, and what will, you know. And then I thought, I'm going to do this. I must do this somewhere. I'm going to do this at some schools. Maybe I can do it at some schools, because it's, I'll have some feedback from the kids, because it's about sex. And so I phoned a few schools, and the Afrikaans one said, near. And the English one says, "Oh, yes, very nice. How much do you charge?" And I said, no, good Lord. It's really true. It's a pleasure. The best thing I ever did in my life. I mean, first of all, how do you ask money to tell somebody that here's something that you might use not to die of? And I did it. I was busy for years and years. And I think a few million children were part of that audience of mine. And I meet them now, the middle-aged men and women, who now say to me, "You know, you were at our school and you waggled that penis around." Not mine, oh no, but a big rubber one, a big white one. And yep. Then I said, "The black one was smaller than the white one." We have fun about that, you know. And I still do it. I still take that story to schools, because there has been no cure for AIDS. People think there's a cure. There isn't a cure. There's treatment. And it's probably quite expensive.
It's
difficult.
Interesting how it's kind of fallen off the radar, huh?
It has. But so I have the, and voter education is also extremely important, because if you don't know what you're doing, you're not going to do it. But if you know that you are contributing to something that might make it a better world. So Evita, we did this in 1999. I did a 6-week trip with Lynn Marie, my wonderful producer and great friend. And we did. I can't remember, 60. We did every day. We did two shows from Cape Town to Polokwane. It was Pietersburg in those days, through Pretoria, through Johannesburg, through Soweto, with Evita talking about voting. What is voting? And voting is you're free. You don't have to pay to vote. And it is precious, and it is secret, and all the things, but also with humor, and in township, Mamelodi, and with some women sitting, you could see their faces, like, "Hey, well, where is this? What?" And then somebody would say, it's a man. And they love you. They come and they hug you. I mean, that's just wonderful.
Sure.
Okay. So you do this and you do that. And so I went to schools and I've been doing that. And that's also part of my inspiration. You go to a room full of young kids who, first of all, give you the time and don't spend time with their little machines.
Right.
I love it. And it's and I say to them, I say, "Listen," when I started the AIDS thing, and I said, "Listen, I'm 45 and you're 14. Let's make a deal. I make you feel 20 and you can make me feel 16. And then we're on the same level, you know, we have the same
right
energy.
When you talk about things like history, and I'm afraid not enough people read history books, not enough people are interested in their own personal history. They don't ask their parents questions. Grandparents, the things that you've been through that have been the source of so much pain and anguish later on in life that you wish you'd done. And South Africa has a very short memory, huh? I mean, we've already forgotten about the Zuma years. People are already talking about how Cyril's now he's the villain. And COVID. People have forgotten about COVID. But now you talk about Thabo Mbeki and Mandela, and you talk about Pierre. Now we're digging so far back that for many people, these aren't even living memories. These are things that are one page out of the syllabus that they learn because they have to in primary school, and later on they can get rid of history. But in some way, the stuff that you have done is like a bit of a time capsule too. And when people rediscover it, as you said, these young people are doing on TikTok now, for example, it's the gateway into that world.
Well, I hope so. That's why I'm very keen to just remind people that if you go into my pdu.co.za, my website, enjoy the book. The book's there. There's 488 pages of history, and not just history, but hysteria as well, and laughter, and more questions. And it'll keep going. As long as I'm here, not fall over, I'll do the next editions, and they'll also be on the website, because it's like my program with HIV. I don't want to charge you money, 500, to read about where we were, Let us remember where we come from so we can celebrate where we are going. And make no mistake, I am ready to celebrate where we are going. I am not getting my bag packed for Perth.
No.
I have no conception of that. I'm going to keep rattling the cage of people who don't think that there is a future for South Africa. I mean, you know, if you think back 30 years about the politicians who were destroying us, you can't even remember their names. The ones that are hanging around, you know, looting. Okay, we know where you live,
mm-hmm.
you know. We'll come and dance naked in the garden, and then you'll see how embarrassed you are when we don't ask you to be naked as well. So, you know, keep smiling. It's worth it.
Peter, you know, those words of Sophia Lorenz in that letter after your mom died just are going to be with me forever. Be brave. We've all got to be a little bit braver.
Good.
You are a tremendous inspiration. You are a national treasure. And I hope you will keep doing what you're doing for another 100 years.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. CliffCentral.com.